Great leadership is about principles. From our work with hundreds of school leaders, it is clear that those who understand this are the ones who thrive. At Making Stuff Better, we create regenerative spaces. Whether these be through executive coaching, coach training, or our group programs, one principle is clear. The principle of belonging comes up time and time again. So with this in mind, here at Making Stuff Better, we are making 2023 the year of belonging. This show is a series of journeys we will take to explore what belonging means in an international school in the 21st century. What does it feel like? How do you create it? What matters most about it? And do we even need it at all in our schools? Join us as we discuss leadership stories from around the globe and uncover what belonging means today and why leaders may need it to thrive. By me, Matt Hall, and my friend and colleagues, Jill Kelly and Naomi Ward. Powered by Making Stuff Better. Hello, folks. Just jumping on because we are increasingly being asked by colleagues about how they might create more regenerative conversations in their setting. Similarly, lots of people are asking us about how they might bring coaching into their schools, or they may be asking us about how they might train as a coach themselves. Well, with that in mind, I'm delighted that we're going to be running a two-day online training in Prologue. Prologue is our introduction to coaching for educators, and it's going to take place on the 6th and 7th of June. It's for you if you know about the power of coaching, you want to bring a more coach-like being and thinking and doing into your leadership, whatever your role in your setting is. I guarantee it will be an enriching personal development experience and you'll really deepen your connection to yourself and to others. So you're warmly invited to join us. We'll be meeting online from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. BST. Loads of breaks as we go on the 6th and 7th of June. The link to find out more and to book is in the show notes, or you can go to msbprologue.eventbrite.co.uk. And as an MSB podcast listener, if I can say that, you will get £50 off if you enter the code MSBpodcast as you check out. The training is going to be facilitated by Naomi and Jill, who also, as you know, host the podcast and are really, really good at this work. They really know what it is to coach. They really know what it is to work in schools. And the combination of those two things creates a really great training experience. It'll be really good fun, highly engaging, very interactive, and I hope hugely useful to anyone thinking about bringing coaching to their school or just looking to develop their ability as a coach themselves. We hope to see you there, but let's get on with this week's show. Lovely. Well, welcome to another episode of Principled. And really delighted today to be joined by Doug Lemov, who I think is safe to say in education circles needs no introduction. But I'll allow him the opportunity just to say hello and introduce himself. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Naomi. Nice to be with you guys today. I'm Doug Lemov. I'm a author. I write books about teaching and coaching and used to be a school head and used to be an English teacher as well. So, and as we may or may not get into, also a parent of three. So, you know, we can go in any of those directions.
Right. Thank you. And as you know, Doug, we're making 2023 the year of belonging and we continue, as listeners will know, to be exploring this idea of belonging. And you come with a real expertise around that, particularly around the classroom. I want to start with the first question, which is if belonging and purpose are the answer, which we think they are, what might be the problem?
That's a fascinating question. I mean, I guess the simple answer is the lack of them, because I hope that we'll talk about how profoundly old an emotion belonging is. And by that, by old, I mean evolutionarily old, pre-human hominid as opposed to human old. But I think that there are three problems, very contemporary problems that my colleagues and I tried to start the book talking about that have had a profound effect on things like belonging, meaning, and purpose. And one of them is the pandemic, which resulted in isolation. And isolation is devastating for people. We're a profoundly social species. And when you break people's bonds of connection to other individuals and to institutions, it's incredibly hard on them. And I think we can see that in our young people. I've yet to talk to a school head who has not said that the students who came back into their classrooms post-pandemic, if there were disruptions where they were the same as the students who left. And so people have been, cut off from institutions and social connections. There's fascinating research on this. When social psychologists study people who lack social connections in their lives for other reasons, elderly people who have no social connections, they find that it's rough, or people who are just isolated socially, They find that it is roughly the health equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. We're wired to need to be connected to people when we've been disconnected from people. But I think that pandemic happened within a larger epidemic that we have not given enough attention to. And that larger epidemic is the epidemic of the smartphone and of social media and the way that it has rewired every aspect of our social interactions with and our young people's interactions with the people around them. Because we've been rewired and involved in this as much as our young people, I think we've simply failed to give it sufficient attention. Even before the pandemic, Jean Twenge, the social science researcher, had found what she called historic rates of anxiety, loneliness, and depression among young people. And this trend, you know, she's been studying these sort of large-scale self-report assessment survey tools of young people. She's been studying them, you know, she's been looking at the data on them for generations. And she said, you know, starting in 2011, she saw a spike in anxiety, loneliness, and depression, the likes of which she'd never seen. And this, of course, coincides with the advent of the like button and the universality of the smartphone and social media. In other words, 2011 was about the point at which, and I had experienced this as a parent myself, about the point at which you could no longer be a teenager and not have social media and hope to have a normal teen experience. And so this rewired everything about the way that young people interact. Where, you know, all my daughter the other night was describing a friend of hers she hadn't seen in a while, and they got together and the sort of friend spent the whole evening on her phone texting another friend and was sort of half present. And for a species that thrives on presence and connection, that's devastating. It's also devastating academically because cell phones and social media fracture our attention, and attention is central to every learning task. So that's the pandemic has happened within a larger epidemic of smartphones and social media that I just don't think we've begun to reckon with. And the third thing that I would point out is decline of faith in institutions. I think a generation ago, people were much more comfortable with the idea that institutions asked you to make small personal sacrifices in exchange for great shared gain. You know, like my father, if I got a call from the principal of my school telling my father that I'd behaved poorly, he would not have stopped to like ask, are you sure you're right? Is this fair? Are you holding all the students to the same step? He would have marched into my room and been like, I just got a call from your principal and your life is going to change. And maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but people lack the data on people's declining faith in institutions. All of them, government, judicial systems, and schools, is evident in all the social science research. And what it means is that, you know, schools are a collective action problem. We constantly are asking people to engage in collective behaviors that will be mutually beneficial to all of us. And it's much harder to get people to do that if they are suspicious of and skeptical of our institution or institutions more generally. And I think that is another sort of mini epidemic that I think that we're wrestling with, and that makes it harder to run schools where, you know, one of the things we have to do to build a strong sense of belonging is to have rituals and consistent ways that we do things. And to ask, I think one of the interesting things about belonging is the signals that you receive are important, and so are the signals that you send, and the small sacrifices that you make to a community make you feel as connected to the community as the benefits that you receive. And it's increasingly harder to ask people to make those small sacrifices. So I apologize for a long-winded response there.
That's really interesting. And I wonder, to what extent do you see the first is also fueling the third?
Absolutely.
Young people have gone through a period of time where the message has been, well, you don't need to be in this building. This institution doesn't really have a purpose anymore other than to be online with you all periods of the day. And now we're kind of saying back to them, come back in. You need to trust us. Yeah. This is where you need to be. We're the authority. I know we weren't the authority for a couple of years there, but we are again.
And I think the second fuels the third also. You know, I think clearly social media behavior, you know, socializes outrage. And, you know, we see the worst in the opinions of the people who are, you know, disagree with us, and the worst of the opinions of people who agree with us. It's easy to live in an echo chamber where we're never forced to not just reckon with the opinions of people who might see it differently, but one of my favorite books is Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, which I think is just, it's fascinating social science research on how tribal we are. But there's a section in it on how we come to change our minds. And for the most part, what it finds is that we change our thinking and we change our minds about things when people who we care about and feel a connection to cause us to think differently about it. When someone who presents himself as an adversary confronts us, we very rarely change our opinions. In fact, it tends to entrench us more in our opinions. And that's what happens constantly on social media. The way that people actually change their minds is that someone who they've met in some other context. You are a parent together, a football team with another parent, and you stand on the sidelines watching your children compete, and you come to build a bond. And then you find out that they come from a very different perspective and a very different walk of life. And actually they see an issue entirely differently from you, but you know that you trust them and like them because you've parented together de facto. And so you're more likely to listen to that person and like think, oh, you know, they really have something to say here. That's the way that people change their opinions. And I think that that's one of the many ways that social media has rewired almost every aspect of our daily interactions.
Appearing these macro contexts that feel quite overwhelming.
Yeah.
And you talk about how we're wired now in the book Reconnect, and then you talk about rewiring, but I also get the sense that this is more than just going back to what was.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. This is a really difficult book to write, in part because the first couple of chapters were about the top, you know, the sort of broad sweeping social changes that could make you feel helpless. And what we tried to talk about get very quickly to in the book are what are practical things that we can do to create a sense of belonging and inclusion and community in our lives, particularly people who run schools. I think that all institutions are important right now, but schools, I'd say, are the most pivotal. One, because, you know, I just think school's the most important institutions anyway. But, you know, we're one of the last institutions left that can set norms for social interactions of, you know, like how many institutions are there left that can set expectations around whether you have your cell phone out or not all day long? Schools are one of the last places that could hope to do that for young people. And what a gift it would be to young people to say, you know, what you do when you go home is your business. We have some advice for you, but it's your business. But when you're here in the building, your cell phone is off and it's turned off and it's in your bag and you look people in the eye and you connect with them as individuals and you rebuild the fabric of your community. And so I think the book is really about rethinking all the things that we do to sort of emphasize, I would just say, not just emphasize belonging and community, but emphasize belonging and community and academic achievement at the same time, because I don't think those two buckets, academic achievement and belonging, are mutually exclusive. In fact, I think they're synergistic. And I know that you agree. So
with that in mind, as you know, Doug, a lot of people listening to this will be running schools, being part of leadership teams that run schools. Where do they go? How do they begin to build these kind of sustainable cultures of belonging, kind of acknowledging what you said?
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe I'll take you through just an outline of a couple of the chapters, just very briefly.
Right.
Okay. One of the first chapters is about just the necessity of restricting cell phones in the building. And that's an incredibly challenging thing to do, but I think an incredibly necessary thing to do and a gift to young people. And you know, everyone who's done this in schools that I've spoken to said at first the young people resist it, and then actually they become very comfortable with it because they find they're quite happy when they're reconnected to their peers. You know, we're all incredibly social, but young people are especially social. And so restricting cell phones and having rules for cell phones and having them away during class is critical. The next chapter is about rewiring the classroom. You know, I think one of the things that schools could think about doing would be making specific discrete times in the day when people connect more and build community more. You could have community circle and community meeting, and you could have advisory groups and mentoring groups. And I think those things are lovely and that you should do them. But I also think that they're relatively marginal in the sense that 80% of the time that kids spend in our schools, they spend in the classroom. And you could rewire the margins, but unless the way that students feel when they walk into our classrooms, unless they feel a sense of belonging and inclusion and purpose and purposefulness, if they feel, in the words of one of my colleagues, safe, successful, and known, if they feel those things from their peers as much as from the teacher, then they will feel a sense of belonging and purposefulness in school. So that's chapter 3 in the book. Chapter 4 is about some of the margin, you know, sort of some of the, like, I think that there's a lot of social science research on values and how there are a few core values that schools can express that bring people together in profound ways. You know, I think that happiness is a misunderstood emotion, for example. Happiness is, there's a social science researcher who says that happiness is made up of pleasure, meaning, and purpose. And we tend to equate happiness with pleasure and pursue pleasure when we want happiness. But interestingly, the research says that your sense of your meaning and connectedness are much better drivers of your sense of happiness in life than mere pleasure. And so can we create institutions? Can we help students to feel those things in the classroom? You know, gratitude is one of the most profound drivers of happiness.
Sean Aker, the researcher, describes a cognitive after image, which is if I socialize young people to look for all the things in their world that they should be grateful for and to enumerate those things and talk about them. When you start to look for something, you start to see it and you start to realize all the things there are to be grateful for in your world, and it makes you psychologically happier. Then the next chapter is about rewiring many of the other things that we do. There's, I think, a fascinating sort of case study of a school in Nashville that rewires its extracurricular programs to emphasize feelings of belonging and connection among students. And so they engineer the audience experience at the basketball games, and they extend tryouts so that even the kids who get cut feel like they've been part of the team. And so, you know, those are some of the things that I think that schools can be thinking about, but I think it starts with the classroom and wiring the classroom to communicate belonging and to students.
And I'm struck when you were saying that, Doug, you said feel so many times to make students feel, and there feels like there's a relationship between feeling the sense of belonging and trust.
Yeah.
Building trust. And I'm also thinking about what you're saying about the pandemic and isolation and the trauma of that, and how, you know, if we think of trauma as being isolated or unseen, then it feels like this rewiring is re-seeing each other.
Yeah.
And in that is a kind of collective healing.
Yeah.
Which feels really a really profound thing that you're doing and that's happening in these classrooms.
You use the word re-seeing, and I think that seeing is such a fascinating, you know, most of our visual behavior is unconscious to us. We're rarely aware of what we do with our eyes and even what we look at. There's a ton of research on this. It's incredible. Fascinating in a lot of directions. But David Eagleman, in his book Incognito, The Hidden Lives of the Brain, says that, you know, a little bit of consciousness of our visual behavior is important to us evolutionarily, but only a little. That for the most part, it's beneficial to us to not be that aware of what we do with our eyes. But seeing and seeing each other is actually one of the most central things to a sense of belonging. One of the most fascinating things that I learned in researching this book is something called the cooperative eye hypothesis. And it's basically, I don't know if you're aware of this, but humans are the only primates on Earth that have white sclera. And your sclera is the white area around your pupils. And so evolutionary biologists have sort of been speculating on this. And what they say is, and maybe this is a little bit of a bird walk here, but I think it's actually central to everything in the book, is that when we think of evolution, we think of it as we live in the most individualist cultures now in the history of humanity. And we think of evolution through an individualist lens. And we think that we had big brains and opposable thumbs, and we stood up on the savannah. And because of each of those individual traits, we triumphed over other species and other subspecies. And that was how we became humans. But in fact, through most of evolution, if you had stood up on the savannah with your big brain and your opposable thumb, you would have been in something else's stomach in short order. And we were prey more than predators until the moment when we learned to work together, specifically to throw stones. That William von Hippel, who wrote the book, The Social Leap, has this beautiful line. He says, you know, a single Australopithecus who could throw stones would be in the belly of a slightly annoyed and slightly bruised leopard fairly quickly, but a group of 10 or 20 Australopitheces who could rely on each other to stand and throw stones and protect one another could actually drive away a lion or a leopard. And that was the moment when we went from prey to predator, was when we realized that we could work together, and that only those humans who worked together and formed collective, collaborative, supportive groups were the ones who triumphed through evolution. And so we're drawn to be groupish. And the reason that we have white sclera is because our eyes communicate so much of our status within the group. You walk into a group and you get a hard stare and you know that you're in trouble. You get a flirtatious glance and you know that it's good news. You know, when you look around a room, people advertise their gaze to you, and their gaze tells you about your exile to a human through most of our evolutionary history is death. And so we're extremely sensitive to a sense of like, am I still part of this group? Am I still important in this group? Do I have status in this group? And an incredible amount of that information is communicated through our eyes and how we look at each other and whether we look at each other and whether you walk into a group. And, you know, one student that I interviewed for this book described coming back into school after pandemic and seeing her friends in the hallway for the first time. And being so excited to see them, and her friends are all looking down at their phones and they don't really even look up to greet her. And it's just like, you know, this is whatever the opposite of communicating belonging, like not receiving eye contact from your peers when you walk into a room is devastating. And so whether we see each other and how we look is critically important. It's, you know, we've evolved to have white sclera, to be the only primates that have white sclera, because we're the most groupish, we're the most social, And that information is so critical to us. So I'll save the story for maybe later in your vote, but this sort of very powerful maths classroom that I tried to profile in a book, which is run by Denarius Fraser, one of my co-authors. The way that students look at each other in this classroom is so profound. And there, Daniel Coyle describes belonging as a flame that needs to be constantly fed. And you can get up in front of your school and say, we all belong here. We're all members of this community. We all respect and care about each other. And that will have 1/1000th the effect of, you know, the tiny moments when the flame is fed or not fed, when people communicate to each other, you belong here, I care about you, I notice what you do.
Yeah, I read about that classroom, and it's the physical turning towards the person when they're speaking and looking at them and tracking them, I thought was really beautiful. And I'm wondering, we're talking about the students, and I'm wondering about the adults as well. Mm-hmm. Within the school community, and whether this is something that can be translated and is useful for those communities as well.
Yeah, on two levels. One is that, you know, when the classroom communicates a sense of belonging and purposefulness and we feel connected, the students are happier and they're more risk tolerant and they feel psychological safety. And so they do their best work. But so do the adults. So does the teacher. You deserve to feel joy and pleasure when you walk into your own classroom. And I think like these habits that Denarius has created in this classroom, they also affect the adults. But then I also, if the core argument is, it's the way that we do our everyday work together, it's what we do in the classroom that communicates belonging. I think there's a sense of that in meetings also, which is like, can we set norms for the way that we meet? I think a meeting should set people's minds on fire, and it should feel like a great class, and it should be carefully planned and prepared and interesting. And there should be social norms about the way that we talk to each other. And if you, it's the same in the classroom, right? The great majority of students, we ask them, students in all classrooms, but in many classrooms, we ask students questions like, what did you think about how Jonas is changing in the novel? Please tell us your deepest thoughts about the novel. And the students look around at their classmates and they're looking away and they're looking out the window. They're looking down, they're slouched in their chairs, and their body language says, I don't give a damn what you're saying right now. And who in their right mind shares their deepest thoughts in an environment like that? Is it any different in faculty meetings? Are we looking at each other and saying, I care about what you're saying. It's important to the well-being of our children. This interests me and excites me, and it sets my mind on fire when you talk about the small changes that we can make in our school culture to make students feel a stronger sense of belonging. And so, I do think there's an analogy there in sort of meeting dynamics and how we run meetings. You know, how we do our daily work is how we communicate belonging to each other.
And I think that idea of the flame, like this isn't something that ever ends.
Yeah.
It's an affirmation, because our sense of belonging is fragile.
It's constantly fed, and it's constantly fed by small details that we're so familiar with that we're likely to overlook them. You know, we don't particularly attend to where we look with our gaze, but there's this beautiful moment in the maths class in the book it's a room full of 16 and 17 year olds. It's a trigonometry classroom. They're having a discussion about this problem. And there's a student, Vanessa, and she's arguing for one solution to the problem. And she's kind of like, not quite lecturing, but she says to the class, if you check your notes, she's pretty sure that she's right. And in the middle of describing the solution that she thinks she's found to this problem, she realizes that she's dead wrong in front of a room full of 16 and 17 year olds. I've had a couple of 16 and 17 year olds in my house. They're not easy to be wrong in front of. But she laughs and she says, actually, I want to change my answer. I think the answer is A. And she's humble and self-deprecating, and she laughs. And it's this beautiful moment. It speaks to her humanity as a student. But if you look around that classroom in the moment when she says that, her classmates are turned to face her and they're looking at her with their eyes and they're smiling, and each of them has a different expression. But in looking at her, they're saying, what you're doing right now is important, and we support you, and we value what you're doing. And when you get it wrong and get it right, and you reveal the like, we're with you all the way. And that is as central to her, to the beautiful humanity that she shows, as anything that she does, right? As much about the class as about her. And these are these tiny belonging signals that they're sending, turning around to look at her, smiling with their, their eyes sort of engaging hers, that say, you belong here, we're connected, that people, they're so familiar that people tend to overlook them, but they're actually some of the most central drivers of our behavior.
Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely scene you describe. And it takes me on to kind of, maybe it links to something you said before around how do you lead this? There'll be people listening, yeah, thinking,
right, great, you know, I'm going to create my belonging strategy and one, we're going to ban phones and that's going to be painful, but we're going to go through it. But there's something I think you're touching on there, Doug, around like the difference that the small can make to the large, like the relationship between these kind of micro moments.
Yeah.
But again, with my kind of school leader lens on, what are the implications of that for school leaders or the other, that function?
The beautiful thing about this lesson that I was describing that Denarius teaches is he says almost nothing in this lesson because all of his work has been done in installing procedures into the classroom that have become routines and that then become norms. I don't know if you've read Peps McRae's book, Motivated Teaching. It's a sort of beautiful, concise study of student motivation, but he says that, you know, people's perception of the group, of the shared group norms around them is the greatest influence on their behavior and their motivation. And so, you know, Denarius has started by setting some procedures in place in the classroom. They're for things like, you know, how do you do a turn talk from like when, you know, the first day of class, he said something like, when a classmate is talking, it's really important that we look at them, we'll look at each other, and that will, one, help you to pay attention and learn more from what your classmates say. It will allow you to communicate your support to them. It will create an environment where all of us are, if we feel supported, we won't be afraid to take risks and we'll do our best work and we'll all achieve a little bit more. And I'm going to, it's a collective action problem, right? I'm going to ask you to do this as a habit. I'm going to ask you to do it even on days when you're a little bit tired. And I think that you'll find you're like it. And so he does, you know, he starts with that as a procedure. And when it becomes a norm, which is when I know that my, when I can rely on the fact that my classmates will do it, then it starts to shape my behavior. And I really do, you know, start to engage in behaviors that show that I feel psychological safety. I think one of the other sort of, one of the other tiny norms that he's put into place in this classroom is one that some people might find odd, which is that kids snap or click for each other. And so I think, you know, every human being, when they talk to a room full of people, there's a tiny part of us that says, is what I'm saying making sense right now? Do I sound stupid right now? And so clicking, the snapping is something that students do for each other, which just says, I support you, keep going, you're doing fine. And so there's this moment where like a student is speaking in class and you can hear the clicking start and she hesitates and she keeps going and she gives, you know, an answer that is twice as long as what she would have ordinarily given, which is like, first, her goal was to say what I need to say to reasonably equip myself of being called on in this classroom. But as she starts to get this clicking from her peers, she says more than she has to. And she goes really deeply into the math. And then there's a moment a few seconds later where actually one of the students starts clicking and she's actually looking around at her classmates, trying to get them to start clicking too. And her body language, if you watch her in this moment, is like, do you guys even hear this? This is so good. You should be clicking too. And it's interesting because Denarius hasn't asked her to do that. What she's telling us in that moment is how much she values it and how much she likes the way it feels when the classroom is team sport and she knows constantly that she's supported by her classmates and she's a culture warrior. She's willing to do her part, not only to snap also, but to encourage it in other people to build this fabric. And so these tiny, small procedures, they become routines. When they become routines, you can do them without thinking about them, without any load on working memory. And then they become predictable. And when they become predictable, they become norms and they start to shape behavior and motivation. And you get this classroom full of kids talking about trigonometry that is the most scholarly and engaged and inspiring classroom that you could imagine. And I think what's so fascinating is that it starts from something relatively mundane, which is like procedures and routines. And this is how we're going to do it here. We're going to intentionally build a culture that will bring out the best in all of us. And I know that there are some people who find that coercive and, you know, telling kids what to do with their bodies in the classroom, but the power of what they get back from that and this moment where the other students are like, are encouraging other students to engage in it more shows how much they value it when it happens in this community space.
So I hear that beautiful illustration of the cues that are happening in the classroom. And I know there's in the book, you talk about the importance of defining your beliefs as a community around belonging, connection, purpose. How have you seen that done to sort of take in all the stakeholders and make it meaningful?
You use the word beliefs, and I think that's really central to how this is accomplished, which is we have to know and articulate what we believe in to be a community. That I think every community and every culture is knit together by rituals and language and belief. And maybe I think I sort of gave short shrift to the chapter on values, but I think this is one of the most central things that we do, which is we identify a small number of things that we believe as a group and the pursuit of them drives us together and creates for us an identity. I'm just thinking about the moment where Denarius said to his class, okay, in this classroom, I'm going to ask you to track the speaker and to snap or click for each other when you support each other. There are a bunch of other things that he does, but like, how do you make that argument to students? Well, one of the ways that you do it is you say that one of our values is community, and that like we make each other stronger, you know, that we make each other stronger by expecting the best of each other and supporting each other constantly. That is who we are. And so this behavior is in keeping with that value. When we do workshops for teachers on building climates that are academically, you know, where the behavior supports academic rigor and achievement, one of the first questions we ask is, what's the difference between culture and behavior? And culture is a shared set of beliefs, and you can't, behavior always happens in the context of culture. And when you have a clear culture that we've articulated and we've all said that we agree in and believe and understand why we believe in those things, then it's very easy to talk about the behaviors that align to that culture. If you skip the step of what do we believe in, what is our culture about, then it's very hard to set and ask for specific actions from people. Difficult for them to make decisions about what the most productive actions are. But when they understand what our purpose is, then they support, you know, the norms that we set, and they start to think about, internalize those values of things that they can do to advance those things. So I think what that chapter is about, choosing 5 or 7 values that you want to stand for as a community that are in keeping with your vision and your purpose. And I think that's a harder thing to do. Now, you know, it's, people sometimes are uncomfortable talking about values. People have very different values. But I think it's a really important step. Say, this is what we stand for as an institution. This is who we set out to be. And the rest of the people of this community have chosen this community because we're a community that is about gratitude and community and mutual support. And so we will ask you to engage in behaviors that support that. So I do think, you know, I think there's a lot of time and energy spent in schools on socio-emotional learning. And I think a lot of it is poorly done. And to me, at least, I think the most powerful way to build a socio-emotional climate where students thrive is to be really clear about a set of positive values that are about who we want to be in the world. And then our work is the endeavor of seeking that together and feeling the benefit, feeling both the benefits and the small sacrifices, right? When you, again, and students are telling us in that classroom that they appreciate benefits that they get and that they're willing to make the sacrifices, and the small sacrifices that they make bind them to the community as much as the benefits do.
Yeah. And that sense of that being a work, being kind of a process, not a, you know, often I think that leaders are hijacked into thinking that it's, I've got my values, there's the 6 of them, there they are behind the reception. Now, great, we've done that bit of consultation, we're clear, but actually living and breathing them and aligning behaviors with them and bringing them into meetings, using them all the time, it's how you really bring them alive.
Right. Constantly have to be constantly part of the fabric. They're another example of like, you know, a tiny flame that has to be constantly fed, which I just love that line from Daniel Coyle. I feel like that's the roadmap to running effective organizations. It's identifying what are the flames that want to constantly feed.
It feels like the conversation is almost mirroring the journey of the book, which is from this kind of overwhelm of the forces outside of our control through to kind of autonomy and hope.
Yeah, there are things that we can do. And in fact, they're often the things that we have often done, but maybe have lost sight of. I think there's I think what you said at the beginning, Naomi, is that like it's different now than it was before, but a lot of the solutions are traditional things that maybe we've lost sight of in some ways, which are we decide that we believe in things together and we're willing to sacrifice for them. And we want to have a shared language to talk about them, and we're going to make them a constant part of our lives. And, you know, I'm just thinking again about being a parent and all the times when my kids sort of slightly ironically tell each other what dad is going to say in this situation. You know what dad's going to say, but that tells you that they know. They say it slightly, they roll their eyes a little bit, but they also believe, they're saying it because they believe it themselves, and it tells you that they know what the values are of the organization, in this case, the family. And when young people talk about the adults who inspire them, you know, often it will be like a coach, and they'll tell a story about the coach who demanded so much of them. And maybe they even like exaggerate how many sprints they had to run for this coach. But what they're telling you is they love this coach was memorable to them because he or she had high expectations for them and pushed them to be their best. In the end, those are the most memorable experiences for young people. And that is why they're telling that story.
Well, I'm going to stop kicking.
Just even just that reflection there about I'm the father of three kids and just thinking about what's our institution. And sometimes I think as parents, that's inferred or accidental. Yeah. When actually thinking about, you know, my kids do the same thing, but I've never really think about why. But yeah, what values am I communicating, and am I being intentional about it? It's a big takeaway for me.
So thanks so much. I really appreciate your time and your insight. If people want to know more about your work, I know you've written many books, and obviously we focus more on the most recent one, but where do we go? Where do we go to find out more?
Yeah, thank you. And by the way, I've really enjoyed the conversation as well. TeachLikeAChampion.org is the website my organization runs. And if you add a /blog to that, I try and write a couple times a month, share little videos and thoughts and observations. So that's a good place to be in touch. Despite all my loathing of social media, I'm on Twitter at Doug_Lamov. So you can find me there as well. And the books are available. Well, get them on Amazon. Ideally, you'd find them at your local bookseller and build a little community too.
Sounds like a great idea, and yeah, we can strongly recommend it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Yeah, enjoyed it.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you for coming along with us on this principal journey. To learn more about making stuff better and how we can help you and leaders in your school, please do get in touch through hello@makingstuffbetter.com. Alternatively, you can find us in all the usual places like LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Links are in the show notes below. And don't forget to subscribe, and if you can, leave us a review. That's all for now. See you next time.